I call the House Higher Education, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum, and we have a couple of amendments, or excuse me, a couple of minutes to go through. So, Chair Wolgamont, have you looked at the minutes from April the 10th?
Madam Chair, I have looked at the minutes from April the 10th, and I would like to move their adoption or approval.
Chair Wolgamont moves the approval of the minutes from April 10th. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Chair Wolgamont, have you looked at the minutes from April the 3rd?
Madam Chair, I have thoroughly examined the minutes from Thursday, April 3rd, and I would like to move their approval.
Great. Chair Wolgamont moves the minutes from April 3rd for approval. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Minutes are approved.
First thing I check.
Okay. Then I will move House File 2312 before the committee, and we do have a DE. Chair Wolgamont, would you like to move the DE1?
Madam Chair, I would like to move the DE1 amendment.
Okay. And so this motion will be to put it in front of us, and we will be voting to re-refer it to Ways and Means. So the DE1 is before us. I think what we'll do is we'll adopt it and then we'll discuss it. So all those in favor of adopting the DE1 so that it is in the shape that we would like it, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Now the amended House File 2312 is before us. And with that, we'll speak to the amended bill. And we're going to turn to nonpartisan to go through. We'll start with Mr. Savory, if you want to go through the spreadsheet, because it's primarily a budget bill. Mr. Savory.
Chair and members for the tape, Ken Savory, nonpartisan House Fiscal Analysis Department. I'll be going through a spreadsheet that was included in member packets. You'll see it's timestamp in the upper right-hand corner that says 4/17/2025 at 3:22 p.m. And then primarily we'll be working from the columns that are all the way on the right-hand side. You'll see column number N, or excuse me, letter N through letter V will be primarily the columns we'll be working from today. Additionally, there are other columns. You'll see column C through J speak to the forecasts in February, both the 26-27 biennium and the tails, and then columns J through M are the governor's columns, but they're condensed to kind of save some space and make the font a little bigger. So we'll begin on line number 5. It's the first appropriation in the bill for the Office of Higher Education. It's the state grant. You'll see in column R and V are the changes to the base. And you'll see a total change for the state grant program of $33,448,000. And then in the tails, $35,282,000, which brings to the total for the upcoming biennium of $483,580,000. And then $485,414,000 for the tails for the state grant. The child care grants on line 6 remain at the base amount of $13,388,000. Moving down to line 7 is the state work study program. The appropriated amount is $23,504,000, which is a $5.5 million reduction from the base. And then the identical amount is in the tails as well. Line number 8 is the interstate tuition reciprocity appropriation. It remains at the base amount of $17 million, both this coming biennium and the tails. Line 9 is the safety officer survivors program of $200,000, remains at base. Line 10 is the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program, which is $7 million and it remains at the base amount. Line 11 is the Tribal College Supplemental Assistance Grants. This is $7.3 million for the biennium, or a $1 million increase above the base in FY26-27 and the same $1 million increase in 28 and 29. Line 12 is the ICAP program, the Intervention for College Attendance. And it remains at the $2.284 million per the base amount in the bill. Line 13 is the Student Parent Information Program. It's $244,000 and it remains at the base. Line 14 is the Get Ready Program. The appropriation has been reduced by $60,000 in both 26 and 27 and in the tails, so it brings the total of $300,000 in both biennium for the program. Line 15 is the MINEP, Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, remains at the $90,000 biennial base. Line 16 is the Midwest Higher Education Compact, remains at the $230,000 biennial base, unchanged. Line 17 is the United Family Medicine Residency Program, which is $1,002,000 and remains at the base for the biennium. Line 18 is the MinLink Gateway Minitex appropriation, which remains at its base amount of $13,383,000 in 26 and 27, and then a slightly higher amount of $13,416,000 in the tails, and so those are base amounts. Line 19 is the SLEDS program, or Statewide Longitudinal Education Data System, remains at the $5.1 million base per both biennium. Line 20 is the Hennepin County Medical Center appropriation, which it remains at this $1.290 million appropriation base. Skipping down to line 22 is the Summer Academic Enrichment Program. The DE aligns with the governor's recommendation to eliminate the program, so a savings of $500,000. Line 23 is the campus sexual assault reporting rider, which is $50,000 in each fiscal year, in each biennium. Line 24 is the campus sexual violence prevention and response coordinator, which is $300,000 per biennium. Line 25 is the emergency assistance to post-secondary students. The line item has been reduced, but the appropriation itself has been distributed between the Indian Scholar piece that I spoke about earlier and also the two systems. So here you'll see a negative number of negative $7,158,000, but you'll see additional lines that pick up those as we go through the spreadsheet. Line 26 is the grants to teaching candidates in shortage areas. It's a $1 million base in each biennium. Line 27 is the grants to underrepresented teacher candidates. It's $2,250,000 and remains at the base amount for each biennium. Line 28 is the students with intellectual and developmental disabilities grants. It's $400,000 in each biennium. Line 29 is the Loan Repayment Assistance Program for attorneys, or known as LRAP. It's $110,000 each biennium. And skipping down on a few blank lines, you'll see the next change is on line 32, which is the student loan counseling appropriation. It's a negative $400,000 savings in FY26-27 and the same savings in FY28-29. Line 33 is the Hunger Free Campus Act. It remains at its base amount of $2 million in each biennium. Line 34 is the Fostering Independence for Higher Education Grants. It remains at its base amount of $8.832 million in both biennium's. Then moving down, there's a few blank lines until you'll see an appropriation on line 38 for concurrent enrollment courses that shows a $680,000 savings in both biennium's. Line 39 is the Student Parent Support Initiative. This is the reduction in the 26-27 biennium of $4 million. And then in the tails in 28 and 29, the program appropriation is eliminated. So the program has no base in the tails moving forward. And that savings is $6 million. Line 40 is the Director for Tribal Relations. It's $286,000 in each biennium and remains at the base amount. Line 41 is the Direct Admissions Minnesota program. It's $1.3 million and remains at the base amount. Line 42 is the Minnesota American Indian Scholars Program. It's $17 million each biennium and remains at the base amount. And there's a blank line, and then we'll skip down to line 44, which is the Inclusive Higher Education Program, and that's $500,000 in each biennium and remains at the base. And you'll see on line 46 is the Addiction Medicine Fellowship, which is $540,000 in each biennium. Line 47 is the UI reimbursement appropriation, which is $316,000 in each biennium. Line 49 is the appropriation for the North Star Promise Administration and Promotion, and it's $404,000 in each biennium. And then skipping down, there's a change on line 52 in column N for FY25, which is a cancellation, so therefore a reduction of the ALS research program that was a Representative Hill bill. of $15,262,000. And there'll be a corresponding line that will reappropriate the money later in the spreadsheet. And then closing out the changes for Office of Higher Education Appropriations is line 55, which is the agency administration appropriation, which is $12,544,000 in FY26-27, which is a $490,000 increase. And then $12,720,000, which is a $656,000 increase in the tails. As far as appropriations, on line 56, you'll see the total appropriations, which is in column R, $16,640,000 above the base, and the same thing in the tails. There are several transfers that are credited to OHE, and I'll go through those next. They start on line 59. This is the spinal cord and traumatic brain injury research grants. These are transferred to various special revenue accounts in the special revenue fund. It's a $5 million reduction in FY26-27, and the same in the tails. Line 60 is the dual training competency grants program. There's two things going on here. There's a $500,000 reduction to the top line of the program, but that reduction is coming from the actual carve-out of the legal cannabis industry grants, which is a reduction of the carve-out of $500,000. Line 63 is the teacher shortage loan forgiveness repayment program. This is a $400,000 savings to the program due to the reduction of the transfer to the special revenue fund. Line 64 is the large animal veterinary loan forgiveness program, a reduction of $100,000 in each biennium. Line 65 is the ag educators loan forgiveness program, of a $10,000 reduction in each biennium. Line 66 is the elimination of the aviation degree loan forgiveness transfer, which is a $50,000 savings in each biennium. And then both the inclusive higher education transfer of $1.5 million and the North Star Promise transfer of $99 million remain at their base amounts per the forecast. So in terms of total transfers on line 71, you'll see transfers out. You'll see a total there. The base amount as compared to base is a $6,060,000 reduction in transfers in FY26-27 and the same amount in FY28-29.
Madam Chair.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we move on, I just have a quick question, if that's allowed.
Go right ahead, Representative Robbins.
Thank you. So of all these transfers to special revenue funds, have they always been transfers to special revenue funds, or are some of these new special revenue funds we're creating?
Mr. Savory.
Chair and members, the ones I would point out that are newer are the ones for the North Star Promise, which was enacted in 2023. Inclusive higher education is relatively recent within those years. But the other ones, for example, spinal cord, dual training, and large animal, ag educators, and aviation have been around since approximately 2015 to 2016. So this bill does not create any new special revenue fund accounts, if that's the question.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. Please continue, unless there are any other questions, since we're taking a little break. Representative Hicks?
I have one, and I do apologize. I maybe didn't hear, but line 48. The foster care grant wraparound services, it says 1,000, and then it's all zeros after that, and I didn't see it in the changes page, so I'm wondering if you can help me understand.
Representative Hicks, it wasn't in the base.
Got it. Thank you.
Any other questions at this point? Okay, seeing none, continue, Mr. Savory.
So, Chair and members, you'll see line 74 to 98 is just a list of changes that we went over. If you're looking for a consolidated place of what's changing in the bill, that would be where to look. But line 100 is the total general fund impact. So the total between the amount of transfers, the amount of appropriations, is line 100, which is for the Office of Higher Education. And you'll see that compared to base in column R, there's a $10,580,000 increase in FY26-27 and the same amount in FY28-29. Additionally, there's one non-general fund change, which is a governor's recommendation around licensing and registration of programs in colleges and universities. That's on line 105. And those new expenditures out of the special revenue fund would be $682,000 in both biennium moving forward. And Madam Chair, that wraps up Office of Higher Ed. We can turn now to page number 3, which would start with Minnesota State. So the first appropriation you'll see on line 112 is for the central offices and shared services. That's $72,802,000, and there is no change to that appropriation. You'll see the various riders that are within O&M, and many of them are unchanged, but there's a new one that we'll point out as we go down the list. Line 123 is for tuition relief. $75 million remains unchanged from the base. Line 125 is for supplemental aid to non-metro colleges. It's $11.4 million and remains unchanged from the base. Line 126 is the workforce development scholarships, which is $9 million, remains unchanged. Line 127 is the appropriation for Cook County Higher Education Board. It's $600,000. Line 128 is for the sexual assault reporting policies of $80,000. Line 129 is for the Next Generation System-Wide Technology, or ISRS. It's $19 million in 26 and 27, and the same for the TALES. Line 130 is the Z-Degree Textbook Program. Open Educational Resources is $100,000. Line 133 is for student support. It's $6,316,000, and it is unchanged from the base. Then there's a couple blank lines that were one-time appropriations and left over from the previous bill. And then on line 137, there's the appropriation for individual retirement account plan contributions, which is $1,777,000, and then an additional amount of $1,788,000 in the TALES. Line 138 is for the menstrual products of $564,000 and the same amount in the TALES, unchanged from the base. Line 139 is for UI reimbursement of $1,618,000. And there's a new rider with an O&M, which is an increase to the O&M base. It's for emergency assistance to post-secondary students. That is the change from the OHE section. It's now distributed to the institutions directly instead of going through the Office of Higher Ed. It's $4.5 million in FY26-27 and the same amount in the TALES. And then, Madam Chair, there's two additional items that are outside of O&M. You'll see on line 157, which is the Learning Network of Minnesota, of its base amount of $8,230,000, and then additionally a transfer from the public safety bill from the previous biennium for JDAI, Office for Corrections, of $1 million. And that wraps up, Madam Chair, those changes for Minnesota State. And you'll see the total general fund appropriation for Minnesota State is on line 173, and that's a $4.5 million increase above the base in FY26-27 and the same amount in the TALES. On line 175 starts the U of M, and they have several riders that remain at base and a few others that were added in, and I'll go over those individually. You'll see on line 179 for medical school development, $30 million for that purpose, and it remains at base. Then line 180 is for health training restoration. It's $15,600,000. And then line 181 is for the MnDrive program. It's $8 million each biennium, unchanged. Line 182 is the Morris Campus Scholarship Payment Assistance of $1 million and remains unchanged. Line 184 is for system-wide safety and security. It's $2 million and remains unchanged. Line 185 is for UI reimbursement. It's $732,000 and remains unchanged. Line 186 is for menstrual products. It's $220,000 and remains unchanged from its base amount. And then line 187 is a new item. It's for the UMN CentraCare Partnership. It's $3 million. In FY26-27 and $3 million in FY28-29. Then on line 188 is emergency assistance for post-secondary students. This is the U of M share of the piece that was moved from OHE and now directly appropriated. It's $1.5 million in each biennium. And then line 189 is an appropriation of $15,263,000. This is the amount that was canceled in FY25 and now reappropriated in FY26. So it's the same purpose, but now is appropriated for ALS research at the U of M. And then, Madam Chair, on line 203 is the total for operations and maintenance. With all those changes in total, it's $26,262,000 above the base, and then $11 million above the base in FY28-29. And then moving down to the state specials, you'll see on beginning on line 205, and the first one being the ag special on 206. It's $85,844,000, and the same amount in the tails, that's unchanged from the base. Then line 207 is the health sciences appropriation of $18,408,000, remains unchanged from the base. And then there's the College of Science and Engineering State Special on line 208, which is $2,280,000 and remains unchanged. Line 209 is the System Special, which is $14,362,000 and remains unchanged. And then line 210 is a reduction of the entire University of Minnesota Mayo Foundation Partnership. And the reduction amount is $15,982,000. And eliminates the special altogether. So it has no base moving forward.
Okay, Representative Claiborne.
Thank you. And if Mr. Savory could please tell us, on line 209, the February forecast was $18,362,000. And then it goes to $14,382,000, but there, I'm confused.
Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, in the previous higher ed omnibus finance bill, there was an increased appropriation for NRRI. That was one time. The language specified that the rider within the larger appropriation would go back to its original $2 million appropriation. So this reflects the new base amount based on the one-time funds.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah. You're welcome, Representative Claiborne. Any other questions? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Savory. So I was going to just check back on line 187 with the new appropriation for U of M and CentraCare. Is that going to now be built into the base, or is that one time?
Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, on line 187, you'll see in line C, or column C, there was a $10 million one-time appropriation for this partnership in the prior finance bill. That was a one-time appropriation, and it's now not in the base. The DE now puts that money at a different amount of $3 million for the biennium back into the base. So it'll be in FY26-27, and then there'll be a tails amount that will be a base amount in the 28 and 29. So, yes, it will be in the base moving forward.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify, because my understanding was that was a one-time thing last biennium to just get them started, but now they're looking for a base appropriation.
Representative Robbins, yes. So now in the negotiations, that was one of the concessions.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I'm understanding. Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions, thank you, Representative Robbins. Any other questions at this juncture? Okay, seeing none. Mr. Savory, you're almost done.
And then, Chair and members, I would just point out some just in our miscellaneous rider from a different bill on line 222 was $1 million each year for a weather resiliency program at the U of M that is now included within the base. And then, Madam Chair, flipping the page to page number 5, you'll see on line 230 is the general fund total for the University of Minnesota, all told, taking into account all those changes. Specials, O&M changes, etc., is $3,780,000 above the base in 26 and 27, and then a reduction in FY28-29 of $11,482,000. You'll also notice, too, that there is a small amount for the Healthcare Access Fund, and that's included in the all funds total on line 235, and the Healthcare Access Fund total is unchanged from its previous base amount. On line 238 starts the Mayo Foundation, which is the fourth component of the bill. There are two change items that I'll point out quickly. On line 240 and line 241, we'll start with 240, which is the Mayo Medical School. The DE eliminates the appropriation for that purpose of $1,330,000. So there would be no base for that moving forward. And then line 241 is the Mayo Family Medicine and Residency Program, which is $2,668,000, and that would be removed from the base as well. So moving down all the way to line 249, which is the total, Mayo Foundation total general fund appropriation, it's a net reduction of $3,598,000, and that this particular component of the bill would have no base going forward. Line 254 to 261 is just the sum totals of the ones I talked about before. I won't go into detail here, just as a point them out. There's a place where you can see them all in one spot. I would draw your attention, Chair and members, to line 261, which is the total net general fund, which takes into account reductions in FY25, appropriations in FY26 and 27, as well as the same base setting function in FY28-29. And so you'll see in column R, you'll see a dash in the DE compared to base. And since the committee's target was zero, that is a zero. And so the committee has exhausted its target and has made no changes relative to the February forecast. And then I would just point out, Chair and members, just two non-general fund revenue items. These are changes to the licensing and registration piece that the governor brought forward, and just shows the revenue that will be coming into the general fund based on changes to the schedule in which institutions will pay fees. And those match the expenditures to the program as well. So with that, Madam Chair, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. Any questions? Okay. Seeing none, so we did hit our zero target. We were able to put some money into the state grant program and made some other priorities, so you can see all of those on the spreadsheet. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hopkins, and we can talk about some of the policy pieces, primarily the OHE policy bill.
Madam Chair and members, so I'm going to be walking through the actual DE amendment, so any page numbers that I name will be within that DE1 amendment the committee has adopted. The DE1 amendment is divided into two different articles. The first article contains items of appropriation and other finance items. Mr. Savory, in walking through the spreadsheet, has essentially covered all of those, but there are a few items in the text that are worth noting. On page 2, beginning at 2.4, that paragraph B, this establishes a maximum tuition and fee amount for the state grant program that will apply for four-year programs in fiscal year 26 and 27. Next, moving to page 12 of the DE amendment. The paragraph M at 12.6, this is the new language that dedicates the emergency assistance grants directly to MnState. That was previously an appropriation to OHE and was transferred to MnState. Subdivision 5 on this page at 12.18, this is an appropriation of $500,000 per year for Metropolitan State University's juvenile justice initiatives. This appropriation was previously carried in the public safety omnibus bill. Turning to page 15 of Article 1. Actually, back to 14 to 15, paragraphs H through J are the new appropriation items for the University of Minnesota. Paragraph H is for the St. Cloud Medical School campus. Paragraph I on page 15 is for emergency assistance grants. And paragraph J is the language that dedicates $15.262 million in new one-time funding to the university for ALS research in partnership with the Mayo Clinic. Turning to page 19, beginning at section 5, you can see the new transfers section that's in Article 1. Previously, most of these transfers were appropriations to OHE and then transferred to the special revenue funds. But here you can see them specifically in a transfers section that continues on to page 21. on page 21, section 6, that is the cancellation that Mr. Savory mentioned for the ALS research that was previously appropriated to the Office of Higher Education, and in the bill is then reappropriated to the University of Minnesota. And section 7 is a repealer section. This repeals various programs that are not funded and not given a base in the TALES as well. Paragraph C of the repealer is a delayed repealer for the Student Parent Support Initiative, which is reduced in its funding in the coming biennium and then eliminated in the TALES. So it has a delayed repealer. Now, Madam Chair and members, those are the main sort of policy items embedded within Article 1. Moving on to Article 2, this contains higher education policy provisions. Section 1 on page 22 allows Minnesota State Universities to offer applied doctoral degrees in cybersecurity. Section 2 on page 23 makes clarifying technical changes to the Hunger Free Campus designation statute. Section 3 on page 25 makes various changes to the campus sexual misconduct grievance procedures statute. One change from when the committee last heard this bill is that schools are still able to choose, and under the section 3 in the DE amendment, between using either the preponderance of the evidence standard or a clear and convincing standard of proof when adjudicating these kinds of claims. Section 4 on page 27 deals with protections for pregnant and parenting students. This extends the requirements in this section to private post-secondary institutions. It also provides a definition for pregnancy or related conditions that cross-references the definition of that same term in federal regulations. The definition, that's a new change since the committee last heard the bill. However, the actual definition in the federal regulations is the same as when the committee last heard it in OHE's policy bill. Section 5 on page 29 of the DE amendment. This allows the Office of Higher Education to retain up to 10% of an amount appropriated for a competitive grant program for administrative purposes if the legislature does not specify a different amount in law. Section 6 on page 30. This allows OHE to consolidate mandated legislative reports for various programs into a single report. Section 7 on page 30. This is the first of two policy changes that the DE amendment makes to the state grant program. Section 7 deals with the assigned family responsibility part of the calculation. It amends the definition of assigned family responsibility so that any student assigned a negative parental contribution or student contribution by the FAFSA will have an AFR of zero. So negative parental contributions and student contributions are being treated as zero. Section 8 on page 31 makes clarifying and technical changes to the statute regarding institutional eligibility. Section 9 on page 32. This is the second main policy change regarding the state grant program. It lowers the maximum lifetime credit cap on state grant awards from 180 credits to 120 credits. Beginning on page 33, the next three sections all make changes to the North Star Promise Program statute. Sections 10 and 11 are related to each other. They amend the definition of tuition and fees to ensure that only resident tuition rates are paid under the North Star Promise Program. And Section 11 requires MinState and requests the University of Minnesota to ensure that all students who are eligible for North Star Promise will receive resident tuition rates. This is to ensure that the North Star Promise Program and institutional definitions of resident student align with each other. On page 34, the third change to the North Star Promise Program statute. This clarifies that a student who has completed the degree requirements for their first baccalaureate degree is no longer eligible for a North Star Promise Program scholarship, even if the student has not yet graduated with that baccalaureate degree. Beginning on page 35, the next three sections all affect the self-loan program. Section 13 on page 35 removes the requirement that OHE determine whether institutions in other states maintain certain academic standards. Section 14 on page 35 removes one of the elements from the list of data elements that OHE can disclose to a consumer credit reporting agency with borrower consent. And section 15, which is on page 36, consolidates provisions related to OHE's authority to determine maximum loan amounts per borrower and cumulatively for the program, and it also removes the current $140,000 maximum lifetime limit for an individual student. On page 36, at the bottom, is section 16, which affects tribal college supplemental grant assistance. This expands the program so that it provides financial assistance to tribal colleges based on beneficiary students, which are Minnesota students who are members of recognized Indian tribes, as well as non-beneficiary students, which are Minnesota students who are not members of a recognized Indian tribe. Beginning on page 37, sections 17 through 20 all affect the dual training competency grant statute. Section 17 amends a definition to specify that certificates, diplomas, or degrees earned under that program must come from accredited post-secondary institution. Section 18 on page 38 just applies that new definition. Section 19 on page 38 increases the required employer match for large employers from 25% to 50% of the cost of training under the program. And on page 39, section 20 doubles the maximum grant amounts available under this program. Beginning on page 39, sections 21 all the way to sections 24, these all amend the Private and Out-of-State Public Post-Secondary Education Act, which deals with how OHE registers those kinds of institutions in Minnesota. The main change being made to this act involves increasing fees for those institutions to register programs. And those changes carry us all the way to page 43 of the DE. Beginning on page 44, section 25. Section 25 through 45 all amend the Private Career School Act, which deals with how the Office of Higher Education licenses private career schools in Minnesota. Similarly, this section makes a lot of technical and administrative changes to this act, streamlining it, adding new definitions. One of the primary changes made, though, are increases in fees paid by these institutions. Turning to page 57 of the DE. Section 46 amends the statute for the Spinal Cord and Traumatic Brain Injury Research Grant Program. And this clarifies what kind of entities can receive a grant under this section. Finally, section 47 contains revisor instructions to just reorder some statutes in more appropriate places. Section 48 is a repealer. It's primarily repealing the reporting requirements that OHE has consolidated in that consolidated reporting section previously discussed. It also repeals certain rule subparts related to self-loan amounts and limits. Madam Chair, that concludes Article 2.
Thank you. Any questions from members on the policy walkthrough? Representative Liebling. Yes, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wonder, this maybe is more for you or for Co-Chair Wolgamott, but the part we just went through on line 57.14, under the grant program for spinal cord injuries. So the new definition there, I note that you're adding, or it's specifying that institutions are eligible for a grant include post-secondary institutions, nonprofit, and for-profit organizations. I'm just wondering what the rationale is behind that. Are there for-profit organizations that want a grant to do research into spinal cord injuries? Or just what is that actual change that's being made there?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Liebling. So I think this came from one of the bills that we had in the change. I believe this was in the OHE policy bill. So I think when we'll have them testify, unless they want to speak to it now. Mr. Hopkins has an answer for that as to where that came from.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling. So this really clarifies OHE's current practice. They have in the past given these grants to for-profit healthcare entities to do this kind of research. So it's not changing anything when it comes to current practice for this grant program.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 35, 35.28, was that also part of the OHE policy bill? I'm not recollecting hearing that, but I'm sure probably we did, but I'm just not recollecting it. And why would we want to strike that?
Thank you, Representative Scott. That was in the OHE policy bill, and I'll have Mr. Hopkins. I don't know if he has a rationale, or we can ask OHE when they come up. Okay, so we're going to ask OHE when they come up. That was requested they had made in their policy bill. That's a really good question. Thank you for your eagle eye on data. Any other questions from members? Okay, seeing none right now, we're going to take testifiers then at this point. So first person on my testifier list is Paul Sirkvenik. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sirkvenik. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Rarick and Co-Chair Wolgamott and committee members. My name is Paul Sirkvenik, and I serve as president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I submitted a letter to the committee, and I just want to take a minute to say thank you to the committee for giving our students and several of our presidents the opportunity to testify before you during the course of the session, for the time you took to meet with students when they came to the Capitol to talk with their own legislators, and the time you've given Allison Grebner and I to also share with you our concerns and priorities. This, you've had a difficult challenge this year, and I want to say thank you for making the state grant program a priority in a time of very limited budgetary resources. Those dollars that you put there will make an important difference to students who rely on those grants to choose to go to college, to stay in college, and to get a degree. So I just want you to know how much we appreciate that investment. We are hopeful that in the final end of this legislative session, you may have additional resources to deal with all the challenges you're facing, and we will be looking forward to working with you towards that end. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sirkvenik. Next up, we have Mayo Clinic, Nikki Valender. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and we'll take your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Eric and Chair Wolgamott, members and staff. My name is Nikki Valender, and I'm the Director of State Government Relations for Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. As you may know, Mayo Clinic is the largest integrated not-for-profit medical group practice in the world. We are committed to clinical practice, research, and education. Our practice spans the spectrum of care from the most primary to the most complex. Our research efforts strive to achieve translational advancements that result in earlier diagnoses and cures. And our School of Medicine and Sciences focuses on training and supporting more than 4,300 individuals across five schools and more than 450 educational programs. I'm before you today asking for your reconsideration of base appropriations for several important programs. The first is support for Minnesota-based students attending the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine. Mayo Clinic's medical students graduate with some of the lowest medical school debt in the nation, due largely to the private support of Mayo Clinic and other scholarships. The state has played a role in partnering with Mayo Clinic to support these Minnesotans working to become physicians of tomorrow. The second item is support for the 42 residents participating in Mayo's family medicine residency programs based in Cass and Rochester and Mankato. Recent graduates of these programs have gone on to practice in numerous communities in southern Minnesota and around the state. The support has helped contribute to the salaries and benefits of these trainees. The state's current and previous support of these educational programs underscores the significant investment needed to train our future and upcoming healthcare providers. Mayo is proud to educate and train these important members of our communities and would ask for your continued support and recognition. Lastly, I'd like to ask for your reconsideration of funding for the innovative research partnership between the state, University of Minnesota, and Mayo Clinic, known as the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics. As you heard in testimony earlier this year, this is a proven partnership that has led to new clinical trials, patents, and care innovations. The partnership is aimed at helping to keep Minnesota at the forefront of medical science discovery and innovation, and is supported and complemented by the robust research operations of Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota. So in closing, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to these important programs and ask for your reconsideration of the programs found on lines 210, 244, and 245 of your spreadsheets. Mayo Clinic recognizes the tight budget constraints facing the state and your committee. However, we would implore you to reconsider removal of funding for programs focused on training tomorrow's healthcare workforce and cultivating innovative research. Educating and training these individuals and achieving scientific advancements are needed steps to ensure that we as a state are well positioned to meet the healthcare needs of our communities in the future. So thank you for listening to my testimony, and I look forward to working with you.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, next up we have A. Scoff from Foster Lead. And on deck is Travis Matthews after that. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue.
Hi, my name is A. Scoff. It's nice to see a lot of your familiar faces, and I would like to thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to speak with you all today. Can I just start whenever? Okay. So, hello, my name is Ace Goff, and I will be one of the most powerful foster voices that you will be hearing from today. I would like to first thank you for giving me the time to speak with you all, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the most consistently overlooked and underserved groups in our state, which is foster youth. Oh, I remember seeing that when I first stepped into the world of advocacy, I was warned that it would be hard, I would be disappointed, and honestly, they were right. But nothing prepared me for the disappointment that we're feeling right now. Here again, we're having to prove our worth of why we should be enough to be invested in. Remember, we didn't break this system, we inherited it, and yet we are the ones, here again, being asked to fix it, with limited support, broken promises, and also shrinking trust. We are promised a path towards stability and a path toward the future. The fake program has also been giving us just not only a sense of hope, but has helped many fosters accomplish the dreams that they never thought they would reach. There are plenty of fosters all over the state who have been breathing easy since they know that they can go to school and pursue their education. This has given us the option to better our future, but it also gives us the opportunity to have our hands in something. Now, don't get me wrong, I may have a powerful voice, but it would be gravely unfair to say that the possible other 45% of fosters that have to be on that wait list are any less important or that their voices matter any less. So here's my ask. Fund the programs that are working. Listen to the foster youth. Listen to the people that will be affected by this. Please stop asking us to just our humanity. Please stop asking us to justify our humanity, and please start taking action. Please honor your promises, because I can promise you that we're not going anywhere. We will keep showing up. We will keep fighting. And it also just doesn't have to be this hard, but it always shouldn't have to fall on us. So please stay with me. There will always be another group of fosters. They will always have faced heavy battles, and they will always look to the state for help So let us together make this a little bit easier for them. You may call it strength, but we call it survival. We carry the wounds that we didn't cause, the responsibilities that we didn't choose, and the silence that we never agreed to. In this world, our strengths are praised, but our pain is ignored. So once again, my name is Ace, and if you know anything about decks and the cards, you know that that means I am one of the most powerful decks, or excuse me, I'm one of the most powerful cards in the deck. But this also means I will help create a blueprint and be a backbone. It also represents strength, value, and it represents an anchor. I have always have, and always will be an anchor for current, future, and former foster youth, but we also need more than that. We need action, we need change, and we need it now. So once again, I would like to thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak to you guys.
Thank you for your testimony. And I would remind members that we held FIG harmless. We had a zero target. There we are. So we had a zero target and we held them harmless. We funded them at the full base amount of just a little bit over $8 million. Welcome to the committee. Oh, go ahead. Do you have a question, Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to highlight that those wraparound services that were a one-time funding mechanism, I do think that is an important loss to this community, and it's important to recognize that. While we all agreed that it was one-time funding, I did just want to highlight that that is being felt in the foster community, too. And so considering in future years to add that back to the base or add it to the base and continue funding that, I think would be really important.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Did you have something, Representative Cleburne?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to echo, you know, our fosters are our children, right? That they're children of this state that we have a responsibility and an obligation to. So I just want to echo the fact that I heard the voice, and it's really important that we keep that front and center as we move forward with our work, whatever that might look like, if we're able to get additional funds or not. So thank you.
Representative Cleburne, any other comments or questions at this point? Okay, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Travis Matthews, and I serve as the Foster Post-Secondary Success Coordinator at Youth Prize, where I help administer the Education Training Voucher, or ETV, you'll hear me call it. I'm also a former foster youth and a past recipient of the Fostering Independence Grants and the Education Training Voucher program that I help administer now. ETV is a federal program designed to help support young people who've experienced foster care between the ages of 16 or 18. Provides up to $5,000 per year to help them pursue post-secondary education, including college, university, vocational training, covering costs like tuition, books, housing, and other educator-related expenses. It's similar in the way of FIG, but it's only $5,000. I'm not here today as a student in need of funding, but as a professional who supports other foster youth pursuing their education and building their lives. This conversation isn't about hypothetical outcomes. It's about real lives. And right now, those fosters are at risk because of an unacceptable funding gap in the FIG program. Let me be very clear. This program is transformational. It was for me, and it continues to be for the youth I work with every single day. FIG allowed me to breathe, focus on my academics, and imagine a future that once felt impossible. Without it, I wouldn't be here in front of you today. I know firsthand of going without this support, financially, emotionally, and mentally. I see the same toll in the youth that I serve at Youth Prize who do not qualify for FIG. They're working multiple jobs, taking out loans, and living on the edge. They're doing all they can to reasonably manage their finances, but the system is full of cracks. Right now, in ETV, we're supporting 82 students. Of those, 20 do not receive FIG. Nearly all of them exhausted their ETV awards immediately, most of it going directly to tuition just to stay enrolled. That leaves little to nothing for books, transportation, housing, and many of those other expenses that you accrue in college. Many of these students have put their basic needs on the back burner in an effort to stay enrolled in college, leading to a buildup of challenges that become really hard to address over time. FIG is not a catch-all solution, but it is a critical step in addressing the inequities foster youth face. This is more than a line item in a budget. It's about whether or not we're truly willing to invest in the young people that the state took responsibility for. I've testified year after year about the importance of FIG. It's not my first time seeing many of you, and why it must remain. And I remain committed, but I'd be lying if I said I wasn't disheartened. My energy could be spent elsewhere addressing other issues in child welfare. Yet, instead, I'm here again, asking for the bare minimum. To fully fund this program so no foster youth have to wonder whether their education or if their future is something the state is willing to support. You have a choice today. You can be the reason why foster youth rise or fall through the cracks. Please close the funding gap. Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
I do just want to point out, as Representative Hansen and Representative Cleburne did, the wraparound services were one-time funding. But the piece of that, so FIG is money to pay for tuition and things like that. The wraparound services fill in when you don't know, you don't have the natural supports to ask the question of how do I fill out this form or who do I go to get this help? And it creates a community and an opportunity for fosters that are lacking in those supports. It creates a support from other fosters of lived experience. And so that was why I asked when Mr. Savory, when we were going through the spreadsheet, because that is very concerning to me, because if we are paying for tuition and the students do not have the wraparound services they need to be successful, we are just paying for tuition. And that is the not the same thing as educating fosters. And so I just am very disappointed in this piece of the proposal.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Any other comments or questions? Okay, then we'll move on. Alexis Borgerson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alexis Borgerson. I serve as the Foster Youth Outreach and Engagement Specialist for the Office of the Foster Youth Ombudsperson, often referred to as OOFE. I'm here today on behalf of the office and as someone who personally experienced foster care in Southeast Minnesota. Our office was established in 2022 after the advocacy efforts of fosters here in our state, some of whom are here today. OOFE's mission is clear: to listen, to inform, to take actions, and to make recommendations to improve the lives of all Minnesota foster youth and to ensure that they are receiving the highest standard of care. We are a unique state agency that is dedicated to offering fosters a safe, neutral space to raise and solve concerns. We officially opened in May 2024 to be a resource for thousands of youth placed in foster care in Minnesota. As a state agency, we have heard from many fosters we serve regarding their experiences with economic instability and isolation. We know this from the data our state collects and from our own experiences. Four of our six staff have personal experience in foster care, including myself. You have heard in prior years, and you hear again today, about the impact that these grants have on fosters, their drive to attend and graduate from college, and the barriers they experience. We are here to tell you that FIG is working. The data is showing that fosters are choosing to enroll in college and persist. In 2023, 500 students received the grant. In 2024, that number rose to 679. As the word spread about FIG, the number of students rose by over 35% in just 1 year. FIG is making higher education attainable for fosters. In Minnesota, the graduation rate for fosters in high school is 43%. It is lower even than students who are experiencing homelessness. Nationally, it has been estimated that 3 to 10% of fosters go on to graduate from college. The data we have so far says that nearly 70% of students participating in FIG are staying in or graduating from college, eliminating the gap between fosters and their peers. These grants are a huge success. We've heard from several states, most recently Ohio and Florida, that they want to copy this program. As a state, we can't afford not to continue to fund FIG. The cost will be higher if we divert fosters to the negative outcomes that we know are a reality in our state. If this budget shortfall is not amended, this means that nearly half of fosters who apply for FIG will be put on a wait list. Students cannot plan to attend school with this level of uncertainty. They cannot rearrange their work schedules, they can't find childcare, and they can't make other adjustments needed with a 45% chance that they won't be funded for their education. This waitlist will discourage fosters from planning to attend college in the first place, steering them away from a higher education as a whole, resulting in those negative outcomes that I talked about previously. Our office often hears loudly about the impact of FIG. FIG is allowing fosters to succeed in higher education, working hard to improve conditions for themselves and their loved ones, conditions that are of no fault of their own and a result of the system that they were placed in. I know how much easier my own path would have been through college if I would have had FIG. So fosters deserve the opportunity to succeed. That's what FIG provides. And as an office, we urge you to continue investing in this life-changing program. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Mike Dean. And after that, Christine Keel from the University of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Rarick, Co-Chair Wolgamont, members of the committee. My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of North Star Prosperity, an organization committed to expanding economic opportunity so that every Minnesotan can achieve their economic freedom and a meaningful future. I just first off want to start off by thanking you for protecting the North Star Promise Program. In its first year alone, this transformative program has changed the lives of more than 16,000 students and reversed a decade-long decline in college enrollment. It is a powerful testament to how accessible higher education fuels future workforce and economic vitality. Yet while the North Star Promise addresses affordability for low-income students, rising tuition threatens to erode the progress, particularly for middle-income families. News coverage last week discussed about how tuition is going to potentially go up by 18% at Minnesota State and 9% at the University of Minnesota. And this will pose a real risk to our students, particularly around their household budgets and even pushing some students to delay or abandon their educational needs. At the end of the day, these pressures will fall especially hard on student parents. And second, that's what I'm most concerned about in this budget, is the drastic cuts to the Student Parent Support Initiative program. This program is a lifeline for student parents, offering case management, child care assistance, and help with basic needs. And they enable student parents to stay enrolled, support their families, and build a pathway towards a brighter future. Investing in student parents is actually a two-generation solution. When a parent earns a degree, their children benefit from greater housing stability, improved nutrition, and access to early education. Just as important, they grow up seeing the transformative power of education firsthand. And today, one in five students in Minnesota is also a parent. Most are women, low-income, and sole head of their household. And nationally, just 8% of those single mothers earn a degree within 6 years, compared to nearly half of their peers. With targeted support, we can change this outcome and unlock the potential of a critical segment of our future workforce. Third, I want to thank you for linking the state grant caps to the Minnesota state institutions. This better reflects the mission and student population at our nonprofit colleges. And the University of Minnesota, as the flagship research institution, has a much higher cost structure, and it's been inappropriate to benchmark student aid to that institution. This change will also work to address some of the funding disparities that exist between public colleges and private institutions. Currently, under the state grant formula, the average award for a private college student is $6,000 compared to $4,000 at a public state university and just under $1,500 for a community college student and only $851 for a tribal college student. And so really want to thank you for making that change and just conclude with urging you to really preserve the ability of the state grant program to recognize negative student aid index. This is not a technical detail. It's an essential to ensuring financial aid reaches the students with the greatest need. Students with a negative SII qualify for maximum Pell and are eligible for additional state aid, allowing the state to direct those limited resources more effectively to those that need it. And without this, our system risks missing the very students who it's meant to serve. In closing, I just want to thank you for continuing to invest boldly in our students, not just as an expenditure, but as a down payment on a stronger, fairer Minnesota. Our future depends on it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Christine Keel from the University of Minnesota. After that, Bernie Ullman from Penn State. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Christine Keel, University of Minnesota. We want to begin by expressing our appreciation for the committee's continued support of higher education. We recognize the current and upcoming constraints on the state budget, and we are grateful that you are able to maintain the O&M funding in our base operations and maintenance, maintain that funding. With uncertainty at the federal level, much of our funding is with research, and we want to work with you to restore the funding for the partnership between us and Mayo. You've heard earlier this session that the partnership has been a collaboration for over 20 years that has brought together researchers from the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic to advance research aimed at improving the economic and human health of our state. Again, we want to thank you for preserving O&M and continue to look forward working with you as we progress towards the end of session.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Oman. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Chair Rarick and Chair Wolgamont and members of the committee, I'm Bernie Oman of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. First of all, I want to thank you for listening to our campuses, our students, and the communities that they serve about the needs in higher education. And I also want to thank you for the respect that you've afforded to all the folks that have come in front of this committee to testify. And even more importantly, in a split environment, the respect that you've had across the aisle has been energizing to those of us that have watched this process for quite some time, and that is a fine reflection of the committee leadership. And thanking the staff for the excellent work, and also for Lori and Sean on helping all of us navigate through the process. Coming into session, Minnesota State certainly understood the financial position the state of Minnesota is in and the shortfalls in the state grant program. And in that context, we appreciate the advocacy that members of this committee have had to get a flat target. And in this environment, having a flat target is frankly a win, which is an odd thing to say at times, but it's just the facts of the situation of that you're in. We also appreciate the robust conversation about adding cybersecurity to our applied doctorate portfolio. That certainly will make a difference. Going forward, obviously with no base increase, coupled with financial pressures that you all know we will be under, it certainly will be challenging. And in the months ahead, I think you can acknowledge that we will be making decisions at our campuses that will be difficult, and we will need space to do that work. It's also probable, as mentioned, that the changes that perhaps happen in the budget reconciliation process at the federal level will bring additional challenges to the state of Minnesota, and higher education will be certainly part of that. And with that, I can assure you we will be looking to be your partner as those issues come up and as they arise and how we address them. Again, want to thank you for your time and energy, and also just for serving on higher education and making it a priority. We do appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Oman, for your testimony. Okay, we're going to keep going. So Ariana Chalman. And after that is Jody Gruchtkin. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, Chair members, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Ariana Shimon, and I am the Interim Executive Director at Foster Advocates. Today, I want to talk to you all about the Fostering Independence Grant, also known as FIG, a program that covers the full cost of attendance for eligible fosters in our state. You all have heard powerful stories, even today, about FIG, and this past legislative session, you all jumped into action when we learned FIG was facing a $5 million budget shortfall. Simply put, FIG did exactly what it set out to do. So many fosters enrolled that the funding ran out. Thanks to you and our advocates out there, we were able to secure that one-time fix and showcase why FIG is unique. And right now, I am asking you all to please increase the base appropriation to match the Senate higher education budget and to truly meet the need. Given your previous support, it felt important that I lift up the impact on behalf of those who can't be here today. I want to clarify that FIG is not held harmless, unfortunately, as OHE projects we will need nearly $8 million per year, not biennium, to meet the current need. So if not increased this session and the current budget proposed stands, we anticipate 45% of current students will be waitlisted the upcoming school year. 45%. That is nearly 300 students who the state promised a better future. There's a deep misunderstanding of what happens to our young people when they enter the foster care system. It's something we do not often have to think about, and it's often overlooked. When the state intervenes in their life, we make these young people a promise that they will be safer, they will be better off, and we know that is just not true when we look at the outcomes and the data for this population. The truth is, as a parent, Minnesota invests so little in fosters' well-being and futures. But FIG has provided fosters an opportunity for an education and an opportunity to create real stability in their lives. FIG is a true investment. It's the biggest investment that we as a state have made in fosters and their futures. FIG is special, and FIG is changing lives. In this work, it is easy to get caught up in all the failures and the problems with our systems because the positives are not easy to find. But when you find one like FIG, it is critical that we protect it and we see it through. At Foster Advocates, we've been collecting stories from FIG recipients throughout the state on how FIG has impacted them. One student shared, "More than just financial aid, this grant symbolizes belief in my potential. It helped me heal, grow, and give back to the very system I once struggled in. I now help shape policy, mentor youth, and work towards becoming a state rep. Proof that when you invest in foster youth, we rise." Of all the promises we have broken to fosters as a state, this is one we can find a way to keep. And by making FIG whole and increasing the base appropriation for future years, we can do just that. We hope after this session we can finish the job, and we hope you will support that effort. We also empathize with the hard decisions that you all have to make this legislative session. So thank you again for the opportunity to speak, and I welcome a conversation with any of you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Shaman, for your testimony. Next up, Center Care, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Rarick, Chair Wolgamott, and committee members. My name is Jody Gerken, and I am the Director of State Government and Community Relations for CentraCare. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 2312. As you are aware, intimately aware, CentraCare and the University of Minnesota Medical School have partnered to develop a medical school campus in St. Cloud to train medical students to serve rural communities across the state. Through this partnership, CentraCare is poised to create several rural residency programs and tracks to address the physician shortage facing rural communities. These students will benefit from the well-established programs at the university, combined with experience at CentraCare's clinical sites in greater Minnesota, for world-class training with a rural focus. These training investments are critical to rural healthcare because we know that physicians tend to stay where they train. The innovative academic affiliation explicitly aims to expand graduate medical education in multiple areas of specialty training to serve the needs and interests of rural Minnesotans. These include family medicine, pediatrics, psychiatry, internal medicine, general surgery, and obstetrics and gynecology. These programs will also focus on care for underserved populations and equip residents to address healthcare disparities. By providing robust residency options, CentraCare aims to build a pipeline of skilled physicians who have training specifically focused on rural practice and will stay and serve locally. So in closing, I would sincerely like to thank Chair Wolgamott and Chair Rarick for including us in this omnibus bill. Likewise, Representative Perryman and Chair Wolgamott for authoring this bipartisan legislation. We are sincerely grateful for the support of this and this opportunity to testify here with you this evening. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So at this point, members, I think we have a question for Commissioner Olson if he would like to come up. I believe Chair Scott had a question about something that was in the policy piece that came forward from OHE. And I know you weren't planning on testifying, but I hope you can answer a couple quick questions if that's all right. Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, good evening, Madam Chair. For the record, Dennis Olson serves as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson. Representative Scott, do you want to repeat your question for Commissioner Olson so he has it in front of him?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Olson, for coming forward. On page 35 of the bill, it's under the classification of data section on line 28. The following language has been stricken, the number of late payments in previous 12 months. And I'm just wondering why that was stricken. It's under the section of what will be reported on a credit report.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, it's a good question. This is something we're treating as technical cleanup language. Frankly, we feel that that's primarily covered in number 6 and number 7, so line 35.26 and 35.27, a little bit of redundancy there. I will just say that the practice of administration of the self-loan program is that we do still report and continue to report to the credit bureaus all the required necessary information. You know, these
our data reporting requirements that do sometimes change. We just had a transition of loan servicer previously with Nelnet, which was a for-profit, now to Aspire. Sometimes those reporting requirements change, and so we'd like to retain a little bit of flexibility, but the assurance is that all those required credit bureau reporting pieces are still provided. So a little bit of redundant cleanup potentially.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That makes sense.
Thanks. See, that was easy. Thank you. Representative Claiborne. Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Claiborne, that is something I will have to get a little bit of a clarification about and hopefully either provide it to the committee afterwards or handle it again in either Ways and Means or conference, if that's okay. Apologies.
Thank you. I forgot to turn on my microphone. So I was asking about lines 35.7 and 35.8, and I would appreciate the follow-up at some future time. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Claiborne. Yeah. He's magical, but he doesn't always have every single answer, but he is quite good at what he does. So we'll look forward to that. Any other member conversation? Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I had also asked about the addition on line 57.14, which is also an OHE issue. It has to do with the spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury grants. And I understand that was clarification language, but I just wonder if, even as I'm looking at it, like, could you tell us, like, what for-profit organizations you've given grants to? And also, as I'm looking at the language here, even the language in current law, I don't see anything about any requirement about what, you know, how the state gets the value back from the research that is done with the public funds. I mean, I don't know, maybe I've missed it here, but I don't even see that there's a report or that, you know, from just for comparison, Madam Chair, the Mayo U of M partnership, it's been a while since I've really looked at that, but there was always a requirement. It was pitched as an economic development thing. I think the representative from Mayo mentioned patents, et cetera. Now, I'm not here to say this versus that, but I am kind of wondering why we would give grants to for-profit organizations and not have any sort of accountability, unless maybe there is some that's not right here on the page.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Commissioner Olson, do you need to phone a friend or?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, potentially, but I will say there are currently, there's a report available on our website. Be happy to provide it to the committee. It does list the grant recipients within the report, as well as some of the, I think, state benefit in results of the, or to the result of the research, I think, that you're asking. In terms of the awards, we're trying to codify really current practice, which was something we had testified on prior. I believe, you know, some of the recipients outside of institutions are entities like the Courage Kinney Rehabilitation Center and some of the health systems, as well as the VA. So those are some of the recipients that are outside of, you know, I think what we would consider an institution award.
Representative,
well, thanks, and thank you, Mr. Olson. I don't think any of those are for-profits. So, you know, I'm kind of wondering. Yeah, I do remember now. Thanks for jogging my memory, the thing about the VA. And I did kind of wonder, you know, that we, with our grants, are funding research at the VA is a little bit strange, because usually the feds fund us, not the other way around. But I just wonder about the for-profit. And I mean, research is research. It's a good thing. Knowledge is knowledge. I suppose it gets disseminated, but when it's done by for-profit organizations, I wonder why they need our money and how they're returning value to us. You know, if a drug company does research, it's not because they want to give us the profits. So just wondering. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Any other member questions or comments, concerns? Representative Hanson.
Chair, do you mean in general or do you mean for the commissioner?
In general.
In general.
Unless you have something specific for the commissioner since he's asking.
Do you mind if I proceed?
Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. So I really want to highlight for folks, like, in this bill, the combination of cuts to emergency supports, loan counseling, get ready, and the elimination of this parent support program is quite literally a direct shot at people like myself who came up without the financial privileges that so many other people do have when they go into college. And I want to make sure that as we make this policy decision, we're at least conscious of it. Because for people who are experiencing poverty, for single parent and young families, for people who weren't raised in money, and for people who, like, weren't, like myself, who weren't taught how to navigate financial systems, and I had to learn how to do so as an adult, and just generally people who are on the fringes of society and are really reaching for a higher education as one of the only ladders out of poverty and out of those situations of disadvantage and just overall struggle. And that includes our foster youth who are now also looking at this gap that they'll have. And these are our kids. And so we have to make sure that we, you know, just at least are aware of that as we go into this. I mean, the get ready part, $60,000 draws us down $30 million, according to a letter from OHE, that from federal grants. That's a hole that we're not going to account for here in our budget, but they're certainly going to have to account for. So I think that's a really important piece. And I can't leave this committee without saying that failing to support student parents is quite literally a failure that we should all lose sleep over at night, because these are some of the most successful students on campus when we actually support them. These are people who are beating the odds in every single way, and just making this choice to eliminate that program is just, as somebody who went through it, all of my college experience with kids, and I don't know if anybody else on our committee has, it's kind of insulting, because we need that support as parents in college trying to provide for our children, especially when we don't come from families that can float us and that can provide for us too. So I just wanted to make that very firm statement about this, because I do think it's something that we, in going into further negotiations, really, really have to think about eliminating it in the base. I understand we have to make cuts. This is a tough year, and I think you guys did a really great job, as best as you could, on so many things. You know, funding tribal colleges, holding FIG at the level it's at, the teacher grants. You know, there's a lot of really great things in here. But as much as I can appreciate that struggle, I really can't leave here without expressing my disappointment with cutting that program permanently. And so I would urge you, please, to reconsider that decision. And I don't know who made that decision, but I hope you have a conversation with me too, because I'm living proof that when we support students who have kids in college, that we can do amazing things. So I'm hoping that this decision changes. So thank you, chairs, for your great work, and thank you to our staff as well.
Thank you, Representative Hanson. That makes me, I remember one other quick question I was going to ask OHE. If Commissioner Olson will return, I'm so sorry. I should have asked you before we opened it all the way up. But several of the testifiers talked about basically the shortfall in FIG. And this was probably our mistake that we didn't have you do a deep dive into FIG, because we certainly did a deep dive into everything else. And so I'm wondering if you could just speak to that, because that wasn't in any of your budget presentations that I recall. And so this isn't something that we've even talked about. So to have four or five testifiers say, hey, you know, you're terrible, you're cutting all, like, we're not cutting anything. We held them harmless in the base because we had a zero target. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that and what are they talking about exactly, Commissioner Olson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try my best here, I guess. You may recall in the 24th session had to fulfill a request to transfer $5 million from the North Star Promise appropriation to the FIG grant, to fostering independence grants, recognizing that we were projecting to tip over the appropriation. Just looking up some quick figures here. So in fiscal 23, that was the first year of the program, fiscal year 23, there were 492 students who received a total of about $4.25 million in awards. Last year, so in fiscal 24, there were 679 students who received a total of $7.25 million roughly on FIG awards. And for fiscal 25, we're projecting that there will be approximately 700 students receiving roughly $8 million in awards. And so we had, recognizing that shortfall prior to the transfer from North Star Promise to fill that gap, we had implemented some language, worked with foster advocates and other advocates to come up with rationing language as well as prioritization and waitlist language if we needed it. Thankfully, we didn't. The appropriation was sufficient. We've made all awards this year and actually utilized the remaining balance to transfer to a state grant this year, but did out of that $5 million, did spend around $4 million. So we are projecting, you know, continued increase in usage of the program. Madam Chair, tough to say at this point. You know, all I have is the information in front of me about 700 students projected to the tune of about $8 million for fiscal 25. And so that, you know, that of course could increase, that could plateau, that could decrease, similar to how we, you know, project state grant. It's something we know at the time, a snapshot in time, but, you know, we'll not know, you know, really what student response will be to the program. I will say, you know, much like the factors that impact projections for the state grant, this, you know, tends to follow that too. We won't really know what the true cost will be until we understand what tuition, you know, will look like in all of our systems, and, you know, when finally the boards kind of settle on those and, you know, establish a total cost of attendance ceiling number, really, and then we'll be able to fully understand what the cost is.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to answer your question that from the foster community, the estimate at least right now is about, without matching the Senate's funding on FIG, we're looking at about 45% of fosters that are applying for college being waitlisted according to the foster community's estimates. So just wanted to share that with you.
Or anyone on the side? No. Okay. Representative Noor. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to reflect on the cuts on the IPS program, the emergency program. We're cutting $2.5 million from that program. That is huge and significant if you look at the numbers. But we're also cutting the parent initiative by $2 million in fiscal year 26-27 and zero, which means a $6 million cut in 28-29. That is going to have a significant impact on parents who have been receiving the program. Parents will continue to go to college and universities, and they still need our support. So we want to make sure that we don't just eliminate the program. At least we can continue to fund the program while we move forward. Likewise, I have got a question about the addition of the cybersecurity. I think we had discussed the addition of AI, and we made some discussion here. I'm wondering what happened to that section under 22.25. Do we have any update how we will be adding AI to that conversation?
Thank you, Representative Noor. So I think you might have been out that day that we had that full discussion. So when we had, in fact, if Mr. Ullman is still here, I think he can speak to that probably more clearly. Mr. Ullman, if you would speak to the difference between the AI part of it and the cybersecurity.
Mr. Ullman, welcome back.
Chair Rarick and members and Representative Knorr, the only area of study that our campuses are positioned to moving forward to in the applied doctorate area is with Metro State and cybersecurity. We don't have any campuses that have come forward in artificial intelligence. And one of the areas that we had the discussion within the committee is, in particular with our partners at the University of Minnesota, that when the issues arise or campuses bring those to us, we know you'll be back and we'll be happy to bring other areas if it becomes something that the campuses can do as a stand-up program. So we're very comfortable with the language that's in the bill.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. So we did have a full conversation about that when we had MinState in front of us and settled on cybersecurity for very good reasons. Okay. Representative Hicks, I believe you had a question or comment.
I have a comment. The elimination of Mayo Clinic's residency and medical while expanding in other areas, taking away funding from a program that has been around for a long time and has been very successful. This isn't the residency program based in the big shiny marble building in Rochester. This is the residency program that was absorbed in Mankato. This is the residency program in Cassin and in Dodge. This is the Family Med residency program that places Minnesota residents, well, the school. School funding is for Minnesota students to go to medical school. And the residency program is family medicine in greater Minnesota. With our largest private employer that is consistently creating the economic driver of the state. Rochester has become the economic driver of the state. We are the fastest growing city in the state with an employer that employs over 50,000 Minnesotans. And we are expanding and creating new programs to do the same thing that we have been doing and been doing well in Rochester, even absorbing Mankato's program 2 years ago. I do not understand why we are targeting just Mayo. It feels very targeted, and it feels a little unwarranted, given that they have been consistent good partners in this space. And so I just wanted to say out loud, we're investing $10 million to create a rural residency program while dismantling one that only cost us three.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. So the $10 million was one time, I'm just putting the facts out there, you know, not defending it, just it's $3 million for center care. But I think maybe Chair Wolgamott might want to speak to that because that was his one of his top priorities.
Thanks, Madam Chair. That's correct. The $10 million was a one-time appropriation from the previous biennium. What this bill before us includes is $3 million ongoing.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Representative Coulter, then Representative Liebling, and was there someone on this side too? Nope. Okay. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. First of all, I just want to thank members and as a former staffer, I can't forget to thank staff as well for your hard work over these last few weeks. And I do want to acknowledge that I do think it is deeply important that this budget does preserve the North Star promise. I can tell you, having spoken with a lot of folks at a lot of campuses, that it is making a huge difference for our students and for Minnesota families. And I'm really, really glad that we are moving forward on that. And I do think it is important that we're taking a swing at addressing the shortfall in the state grant program as well. I won't sort of rehash everything that's been said about the cuts that are in this bill. The Student Parent Support Initiative, as somebody who was also a parent when I was became a parent when I was in graduate school, that is concerning to me. And as Representative Hicks said, the cuts to the Mayo partnerships, that is concerning to me as well. In particular, I want to touch on some of the cuts that are being made to loan forgiveness programs and the elimination of the loan counseling program as well. Particularly given the news today about federal action regarding student loan payments. It feels to me that we are sort of going in the wrong direction on that. And those of us like myself who graduated from college in May of 2008 and then saw the entire world economy collapse 4 months later, student debt, and many of us of that generation saw student debt become something that has really held a lot of folks back. And my fear, frankly, with the choices that we are making in this bill and the choices that we are not making in this bill, first of all, it's worth acknowledging that they are just that, that these are choices that we as legislators are making. But my fear is that we are making choices that are perhaps penny wise and pound foolish. Mm-hmm. And I want to urge us, because I think we could, and I truly hope we do as this process moves forward, make different choices. And I said it about HEPR, in many ways, this committee is one of the best examples of pay me now or pay me later. And pay me later is always more expensive. The results are always worse. So I hope that we're keeping that in mind, as we move forward in this process. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Representative Liebling, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a couple of comments on this. First of all, I just wanted to sort of make the general comment that I am glad to see that we are at least holding harmless the university and Minnesota State. But while I say that, you know, I want to just reflect that in the last 2 years when Democrats included inflation back into the budget forecast, there was a lot of hue and cry from Republicans about how we were putting spending on automatic pilot. In this budget, we see that that is not the case because these organizations are being held harmless. I'm sure they're very happy they're not being cut. But in fact, not getting an increase is a cut because we know that inflation marches on, and we've heard what this will mean in tuition and what it will mean for students. So I think while I am glad that the two co-chairs have reached an agreement that doesn't cut either of these organizations, I think that none of us should feel really good about that because we are passing a budget here that increases costs for students, and that is something I really don't want to do. So that's my first comment. The second one really goes back to the residency issue. And my take on it is a little bit different than Representative Hicks, although I appreciate her comment. But I'm really focused on the residency part of this. As she discussed, the Mayo Family Medicine and residency, where you're basically eliminating funding for that program. And it's $2.268 million per biennium. It's being eliminated. Honestly, that is a foolish thing to do. We need physicians. We need to train more physicians. We especially need family physicians. We especially need them in rural areas. And that is exactly what this is doing. That is what that training is doing. Now, I do understand why Mayo is the target of this, because I think people perceive probably correctly that Mayo has money to backfill, maybe. I don't know whether they would backfill this. This is not a moneymaker for Mayo, I'm pretty sure. So, you know, while cutting money for students who are going to medical school, maybe that can be backfilled. You know, it is a private medical school. As was said, the students graduate with low debt. That's great. Maybe they will have a little bit of debt. You know, that's probably not the end of the world. But eliminating the residency program, I think, is a really foolish thing to do for the state and for our future, because we need more of that, not less. And while I certainly support the CentraCare project, because that, again, is building toward what we need for the state, I think it's a really unfortunate trade-off, just not because of who's sponsoring them, but just because of what we're doing here. We ought to be doing both of these things and more of it. And in the CentraCare bucket, you know, it's I'm looking at the language in the rider. You know, it's great. Tuition support, residency program, that's great. Rural health research program. I don't know if I would consider that a priority, given how tight our budget is, at the same time that we're literally eliminating the family residency program that's operating now, that's been pretty successful, that is getting family physicians out to rural communities. So I think that's a really unfortunate choice, and I hope that that does not persist into the final budget. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Any other member questions or comments? Okay, seeing none. So I just want to kind of level set us just a minute. So we had a zero target. We had a $239 million hole in the state grant program. So that's what we were facing. Now, 1 year worth of grants in the state grant program was just a couple million more than that. So we were facing a hole in the state grant program that was basically the equivalent of one entire year's worth of grants. That being said, we had to make hard choices. I'll just tell you, negotiations were not easy. They were very civil. They were very respectful. But we had to make hard decisions. And I will say that we had OHE in the room. So Commissioner Olson, thank you for your support, your advice, your running of numbers, and you were in the room, you were offering your advice the entire time. So, and your team, honestly. So I want to give you a huge thanks. And of course, our nonpartisan were with us the entire time as well, giving us expert, both historical information, both about the policy and about the fiscal side. So thank you, Mr. Savory. Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. You were integral and to be, you know, we were facing a huge issue. And of course, our other partisan staff as well, too, Sean and Lori and Ben and Evelyn were all there together. And Evelyn had fantastic ideas, so thank you. She brought great things to the table. This was a team effort. It was not easy. I hear you. Chair Wolgamott hears you and the concerns. And so I'll just walk through just a tiny bit of what we did with the levers, because the levers are things that we can control, as opposed to the rationing, which is what OHE had the ability to do. And that's, if we did nothing, then OHE would have the ability and would have to ration essentially one entire year's worth of state grants. So one of the things that we agreed to was not allowing the SAI, so the student index, to go negative, which you did hear a testimony about that some advocates really want it to go negative, because that means that not only are your tuition and fees and all of that covered, but you actually get money back up to, I think the Senate set it at like a $1,500 amount. So that is part of the reason why we had a huge hole in the state grant program, because we hadn't had that before. So when FAFSA allowed that number to go negative, money just went out of the state grant program a lot. And so that was $87.7 million by just saying we're going to go to zero, which had been previous policy and previous law before. So that was $87.7 million of the $239 million. And then I'm just going to give you credit, Mr. Herring, because you came up with another idea that has never been done in all of state history that I'm aware of, and that was doing a cap on the four-year tuition. So if the University of Minnesota raises their tuition, which we all love it when they do that, they did it 4.5% in the last year. If they raise it more than 1%, the state grant will not pay for that difference. That's what that cap of 1% means. So the University of Minnesota system and the privates that have large tuition amounts. So that was a savings. And that's a measure that we can control that cost a little bit, because we all want to control some of the costs. We all want education to be affordable for kids. That was one way that we, the legislature, can say we want to control that cost. So that was another lever that we did. And I believe that was that the 17? I think it was 17 and a half million. We don't know for sure, but it's right around there. I think Ken Savory's shaking his head yes at me. So Mr. Savory knows the numbers like that. So it's amazing. The other change that we made was a change that had been previously changed, where you could have the state grant pay for up to 180 credits, we reduced it back down where it had been to 120 credits. And that change netted 37.6 million in savings. So, and we cut where we could cut, we cut where we could get agreement. So if you ask, why did you cut this or why did you cut that? My team had come up with a very, an agreed upon, a large number of cuts that we could agree to. And so what was agreed to is what was in the bill. Fair? I mean, that's a fair assessment of what we did. So that's kind of where we started, $239 million hole, zero target. We did levers we felt were the least harmful to students, things that had just been changed in the most recent past. We changed them back to the way it had been so that money went out in a little bit more regulated way. We held harmless where we could hold harmless. So we held FIG harmless. Did we add and, you know, did we double their budget? We didn't have the money to double their budget. Did we did hold North Star Promise harmless. We held harmless where we could hold harmless and held it flat. We held the institutions flat. We shifted some money to do some cost savings with administration. So some of the emergency grants that we've talked about was shifted to the institutions so they administrate it as opposed to OHE. So we found some cost savings. So that is essentially what we did. And again, FIG was, it's 8.8 million is the base for the biennium. So those are my thoughts about the process and kind of where we were at and how we walked through it and the choices that we made. We still have to go and negotiate with the Senate. So this is not done. I hear you all, and we'll take that into negotiations with the Senate. With that, I will turn it over to Chair Wolgamott for your comments and concerns.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, for all of the hard work of you and your team in putting together, like you said, was a very difficult negotiation. Again, appreciate the respect and civility and the endless cans of LaCroix that got us to this point. I think it's pretty clear based on the testimony that we heard and the comments from members that, if you were the full chair of this committee, the bill would probably look different. And if I were the full chair of this committee, the bill would certainly look different. But we're at where we're at, and I know that we've left no stone unturned in working together to try to balance the needs of our caucuses, to try to deal with the situation with the state grant program and try to do all that under the constraint of a zero target. That's what this bill is before us. Any compromise, good compromise, not everyone's happy with it, and that's very clearly the case here, but I would ask for members' support for this bill, and we will continue to be in conversation as the conference committee process goes on. We'll continue to be in conversation with every member of this committee for your input and concerns, as well as members of the public as we move forward into conference. So again, thank you to members for the conversation today. I would urge a yes vote on the bill and look forward to working with you all to continue this bill through the process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Wilgamont. Okay. Unless there's any other final comments. Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2312 as amended be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
Duly noted. Motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Thank you, members. And again, before we leave, I do want to absolutely say thank you, especially to our nonpartisan staff that are with us the whole time, to our partisan staff, Laura Cousineau, James Cook, Evelyn, Sean Herring, and Ben Fries back here. And there's a couple more nonpartisan. Do you want to thank your partisan folks, Chair Wolgamont, before we head out?
Certainly. Thank you, Sean and Evelyn and Drew and our team, DFL Higher Ed team. You guys have been an incredible resource through this process and these difficult negotiations, and I'm eager to continue our work together. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamont, and thank you, committee members, one and all. This was a very robust committee. I think it's good to have, you know, seven chairs on a committee. I think we worked really, really well. We had really good questions. Thank you all, and we'll see you on the floor with the bill. Thank you all. We are adjourned.